This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we learn about a massive air surveillance project underway in Baltimore. ACLU attorney David Rocha joins us to understand how and why the police department there contracted with the company Persistence Surveillance Systems to monitor 90% of the city's residents all day long, everywhere they go. The ACLU is fighting to ensure that this program isn't replicated anywhere else.
The fact that there hasn't been a nuclear war that would destroy all life on Earth is, to all people who know something about this, an absolute miracle. We speak with Paul Jay about the forces behind this and what we can do about it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. As the nation erupts in protests against racially infused police violence, the Baltimore Police Department has just launched a six-month daytime aerial surveillance experiment. A Texas billionaire has funded the project that's being operated by an Ohio-based company, Persistent Surveillance Systems. Airplanes fly overhead and record the movements of nearly everyone in the city. Michael Harrison, Baltimore's police commissioner, justified the nearly $4 million experiment by saying, quote, "There is no expectation of privacy on a public street." He clarified that the airplanes will not film while individuals are inside their homes. The Aerial Investigation Research Pilot Program, as it's called, is by contract limited to monitoring such felony crimes as robberies, carjackings, shootings, and homicides. In theory, the images recorded are to be used only in criminal investigations and will be stored for 45 days. A first prong of the program was conducted covertly in 2016 under a different police commissioner. The ACLU of Maryland calls this initiative the most comprehensive surveillance of a U.S. city in history. ACLU senior staff attorney David Rocha likens it to having a police officer follow you every time you walk out of the door. David joins us today with an update on this aerial surveillance program. He worked on a number of significant cases involving free speech, police misconduct, privacy, election law, and more. In 2011, David was an inaugural recipient of the James Baldwin Medal for Civil Rights. Previously, he worked as a senior trial attorney in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he focused on police misconduct and conditions in prisons, jails, and other state institutions. David Rocha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on.
David, in April, a federal court decision allowed an aerial surveillance program to move forward in Baltimore. But this isn't the first time Baltimore has had such a program. When was the first, and what, if anything, is different about this one?
This was originally rolled out in Baltimore in secret in 2016. So secret that at the time it was secret from the state's attorney's office, the mayor, the city council, the office of the public defender, the criminal defense bar, the entire city of Baltimore. The only people who knew it was happening then were the Baltimore Police Department and Ross McNutt, the owner of Persistent Surveillance Systems, the company that has developed this technology and has been looking to deploy it in the United States. When the secret use of this persistent aerial surveillance was disclosed in a Bloomberg Businessweek article, there was, unsurprisingly, a huge uproar, and it was shut down. And since then, Ross McNutt has been trying mightily to convince Baltimore and other cities to use his persistent surveillance technology. And sadly and pathetically, Baltimore decided to become the guinea pig, or I should say, the mayor and police commissioner decided that Baltimore should become the guinea pig for this technology in December of last year, and it was deployed, or it was planned to be deployed starting in April. We sued to block the use of this persistent wide area surveillance of the entire city, but sadly, as you noted, the U.S. District Court here declined to grant a preliminary injunction against it, and that is now on appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Now, who actually funded this pilot program? I understand it's a Texas billionaire. Is that the owner of persistent surveillance?
No. The Texas billionaires are the Arnolds, and they are funding, to the tune of about $3 million, the six-month so-called pilot of this technology here. Ross McNutt is the owner and founder of Persistent Surveillance Systems, the company that markets this surveillance technology. He developed it when he was in the military for use in the Iraq War as a way of attempting to track insurgents who were planting improvised explosive devices. And then when he came back home, saw an opportunity to try to market the technology to law enforcement as a crime-fighting tool.
Why not a drone? I was surprised to hear the technology was being used in an airplane since they're so much more expensive.
Right. I think that's because there are still limits on flying large drones in U.S. airspace, or non-military drones, that is. But if the surveillance technology is allowed to go forward, that is obviously the next step in order to try to bring costs down, because obviously drones can be flown far less expensively than crewed Cessna aircraft, which is where the cameras are, how the cameras are currently deployed.
Now, because airplanes and drones can remain airborne for protracted periods of time, unlike still cameras, they can capture continuous records of an individual's activities. The mayor has said that no one has an expectation of privacy in public places, but how does protracted surveillance reconcile with the Fourth Amendment?
You're right. This technology is categorically different from the ground-based surveillance cameras or one-time flyovers that we are more familiar with in this country. And this technology is the most far-reaching surveillance system ever deployed on American soil. It's important to understand how it works and what it does. So it uses a network of very sophisticated wide-angle cameras which capture in each frame one-third of the city. But the resolution of these networked cameras is sufficient to be able to zoom in and distinguish one person from another. And the cameras record video at the rate of one frame per second, thus creating a slow frame rate video record of everywhere that everybody in Baltimore goes anytime they're outside while the planes are flying. And the planes fly about 12 hours a day. The plan in the current contract is to have three planes in the air at a time, covering more than 90% of the land area of Baltimore. And the net result is a virtual time machine, allowing the police to go to any location and any time, and then trace the movements of every person to and from that location. And the identification, so what the proponents of this, what Ross McNutt and the police commissioner are fond of saying, is that the cameras can't identify anyone, which is the kind of truthy but deeply misleading statement that really hides what's going on here. So it is true that in a single frame of the video footage, because of the resolution and because of the angle of the videography, you can't look at a single frame and know who the person, who any of the dots, any of the people photographed are. But it's worth remembering that this technology was developed for one and only one reason and is being deployed for one and only one reason, and that is to identify people. And it does that in multiple ways. So first, simply by tracing where someone comes from and goes to, that is often sufficient to identify who that quote-unquote dot is. In Baltimore, 75% of the population lives in a single-family house. And so if you know where they leave in the morning and where they go to at night, you can pretty reliably identify them. But identification also works in other ways by being linked to the city's network of ground-based video surveillance cameras so that they will know precisely at what time the person they're tracking has moved past a particular camera, and they can then grab a video image of the person that they're interested in. It's also linked to the city's network of automated license plate readers, which track and identify vehicles, and they can also know when the person has passed private video surveillance cameras that individuals have put in businesses or homes to the extent those are registered with the city, and many are. So there's multiple ways in which identification takes place. And in terms of the Fourth Amendment, what PSS and the mayor and the police commissioner have pointed to is a number of Supreme Court cases dating back several decades, which said that aerial observation of public places does not violate the Fourth Amendment, which is true. But as the court itself made clear in those cases, what they were talking about there was static observation of a particular place at a particular time, not the tracking of the movements of an entire city during daylight hours. And as to that, the relevant Supreme Court opinion is the court's most recent decision in the Carpenter case involving law enforcement acquisition of long-term location tracking data, in that case from cellular service providers. And what the court held in that case was because that movement data is so revealing of private the details of life, and because the data is available as to almost everyone, since we all carry cell phones, that allowing the warrantless acquisition of that data by the government would so alter the balance of power and privacy and structure of our society that they said that acquisition of that data as to even a single person was a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And here, of course, we're not talking about the acquisition of long-term location data about one person, but the acquisition of long-term location tracking information about every single person in Baltimore.
This seems to be the perfect case to bring to the Supreme Court for consideration.
Well, I hope it doesn't have to go that far, but this is game-changing technology. No government in the United States has ever had the power to record, store, track, and have at its fingertips the movement data of the entire population. And I think to give the government that power is profoundly dangerous and profoundly invasive of privacy. It's the technological equivalent of having a police officer follow you every time you walk out the door of whatever building you happen to be in, and record where you're going. And if that happened in real life, I think we would all viscerally and clearly understand the privacy implications. And of course, it couldn't happen in real life. It's only because of these sophisticated new technologies that it can happen. You know, because it's being done remotely from an airplane, we don't have the same visceral experience. But the dangers are exactly the same. The dangers are frankly worse than when the government acquires the information about a single person through a warrant process. Here, there's no court involved at all, ever. The government simply tracks the movement of everybody all the time to be used whenever it wants, and that's really dangerous. And that's, you know, that's the basis for our challenge, and I hope the courts will see it the same way.
David, do you think that the Baltimore Police Department shares the data they collect from this persistent surveillance systems with the feds?
Nothing would prevent them from doing so. Do I know that they're doing so now? There is no way for me to know. What they've said they're doing now is a six-month trial of the program, and the only policies or privacy protections, if you want to call them that, that exist in a contract between the BPD and persistent surveillance systems, which is completely meaningless because nobody can enforce that other than the BPD or PSS itself, and neither of whom has any actual interest in enforcing it. There's obviously no ability for the public to enforce it. And of course, contractual terms can change at will. And nothing would prohibit the BPD from sharing information with any other law enforcement agency, federal or otherwise. So this is literally the privacy nightmare come to life. This kind of all-seeing eye that tracks us everywhere we go outside is what people who are concerned about the, you know, rapid development of technology and privacy and limits on government power have been worried about for decades. And here it is, with Baltimore being the guinea pig for the rollout of this technology.
Why do you think Baltimore was picked as the test city, as it were?
Well, I mean, part of it is a function of the fact that the police department in 2016, shockingly, was willing to secretly deploy the technology without telling anybody, which is just such a, you know, sort of appalling and sick statement in and of itself about policing in Baltimore. Baltimore is unique, certainly in Maryland and perhaps in the whole country, in being a city in which the people of Baltimore have no direct control over their police department, because the police department, dating back to the Civil War era, is statutorily declared to be a state entity, with the city solicitor then taking the position that that means that the Baltimore City Council has no authority to legislate about it or regulate it. And so these decisions are made simply by the police commissioner, who is accountable to no one other than the mayor. And so you have a culture of impunity, basically, which is why the Baltimore Police Department is under a consent decree with the Department of Justice from decades of racist and unconstitutional policing. Obviously, Baltimore is not unique in the country in that regard, but in its lack of accountability, I think it is somewhat unique. And so, you know, I think part of it is because Ross McNutt already had a toehold here, and because he was able to, I think, cynically exploit the misery that this city is experiencing with persistently high murder rates and a sense of panic about crime. He was able to sell it as, we're desperate, nothing is working, and here's my magic solution.
in our remaining minutes, I wanted to note that when you talked about lack of enforceability, I read that the contract, one of the provisions is that the data is only to be used in conjunction with felony crimes in Baltimore, and also that it is supposed to be deleted in 45 days. But of course, we have no way, as you say, of enforcing that or knowing if it's happening.
Well, it's worse than that. When it was used in secret, PSS has publicly said, once it was disclosed, we're very concerned about privacy. We delete the data after 45 days. That was what they said back in 2016. That turned out to be a bald-faced lie, as was discovered when the public defender sought data related to cases it was working on and found that the data had been kept indefinitely, which was confirmed in a report written by the Police Foundation, which revealed that what really was happening was that after 45 days, it was just being moved to a different server, not deleted. There's something just really sick about the fact that here's a company which deployed this technology in secret, lied to our faces about what it was doing, and yet is given a $3 million contract to do it all over again. It's like giving the keys to your house to the person who just burglarized it. It's just, at some level, utterly incomprehensible, and perhaps only could happen in Baltimore.
David, I was surprised when you just said there are three planes. I thought it was just one plane. I know that some residents of Baltimore have complained about the noise, but is there any kind of groundswell, especially as we see what's happening in the streets with racialized police murders and activism calling for changes? What do residents say about these planes?
There's obviously, unsurprisingly, a mix of opinion in Baltimore. There are many people who are deeply opposed to this. There are some people who are so focused on crime and the police department's inability to make a dent in the murder rate that they think this is the appropriate solution. There's certainly many people who think that the way we should be approaching our crime problem in Baltimore, not just with respect to murder, but more generally, is to focus on more proven strategies and community-based solutions like the Safe Streets programs, which employs violence interrupters to be out in the community and seeking to diffuse conflicts before they get to the level of shootings, and which where they've been deployed have been quite successful. But they're not getting $3 million grants from the Arnolds or anyone else, and there's something really warped and wrong about that. So there is certainly plenty of people who are deeply concerned about it, and the person who just won the mayoral primary, the Democratic mayoral primary here in Baltimore, Brandon Scott, is someone who has been an opponent of using this kind of technology and persistent surveillance. So that's a good sign. I think there were a number of mayoral candidates who were outspoken proponents of this, all of whom were far back in the field. So I think that says something about the level of public support for this in Baltimore.
And what, if anything, is the ACLU doing in terms of a next step about this?
Yeah, so as I said, we filed suit to block it. We were unsuccessful in getting a preliminary injunction in the district court. We've appealed that denial of a preliminary injunction to the U.S. Court of Appeals, asked for and received an accelerated briefing schedule. That appeal is now fully briefed, and we hope will be decided quickly, and we hope that the Fourth Circuit will agree with our Fourth Amendment analysis and issue a preliminary injunction or overturn the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction, and that will halt it. We also have, with help from our national office, engaged in a significant advertising effort here, seeking to raise public awareness of what's going on. We see that reflected in the protests that are happening now, with people specifically calling out this program in the protests that are happening in Baltimore. And we're hopeful, either through the legal process or the political process, that this will be stopped. It's a travesty that it's happening.
Well, we also don't want this spreading to other areas throughout the country.
I think that's a real danger, and why we felt compelled to sue, and why we've opposed it both locally and nationally in every forum.
Unfortunately, our time has come to an end. How can our listeners learn more about your work and the work of the Baltimore ACLU?
Information about this case and all of our other work is on our website, www.aclu-md.org, and on our national office website. Our national office has been leading the litigation effort here, and that's at aclu.org.
David, thank you for all your work on these issues and for being a guest today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on and for your attention to this important issue.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The chance for nuclear war, which would destroy all human life on Earth, has never been higher. Just last week, President Donald Trump withdrew America from the Open Skies Treaty. The treaty is an agreement between 34 nations that allows each country to fly over each other's territories. The treaty is designed to provide transparency and mutual observation of military developments. He also withdrew from the Intermediary Ballistic Missile Treaty with Russia. As a consequence, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has pushed the hands of its doomsday clock on its magazine cover forward to almost midnight. Shortly after taking office, Trump pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal. Trump enjoys the financial and political backing of big business, the banks, the hedge funds, and the military-industrial complex. These moneyed interests profit greatly from the nuclear rearmament, which is now going on. First under Obama and then Trump, $1 trillion is planned to be spent over the next 30 years for a new generation of nuclear weapons, including low-yield ones, which are likely to be used. Whistleblowing truth-teller Daniel Ellsberg has recently written the grimly important book, The Doomsday Machine. He believes that so far avoidance of a nuclear war has been miraculous, and that the danger is as present today as it was during the Cold War. He thinks seeking profit, in spite of the risk of nuclear winter, is institutional madness. We're joined today by Paul Jay, the founder and editor of TheAnalysis.News. He's a journalist, filmmaker, and the founder of The Real News. He's currently working with Daniel Ellsberg on a documentary series based on Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. We will discuss with him the kind of movement that's needed to reverse the nuclear arms race, as well as the democratic organization of the society. Paul Jay, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for inviting me.
Paul, let's talk about the nuclear threat and how we could force them to stop gambling with our lives. Do you think a nuclear war, accidental or otherwise, is likely?
The people I have interviewed, from Daniel Ellsberg to Larry Wilkerson, who used to be Colin Powell's chief of staff, I've seen interviews with former diplomats, military people. They all think that nuclear war is not likely. They think it is absolutely assured. It's not that there's a chance, they think, of nuclear war. They think there is 100% certainty that if things continue as they are, at some point, sooner, it could be today or tomorrow, or later, it could be some years from now, there will be, at the very least, accidental nuclear war. That the safeguards simply aren't safe enough, and that this new investment, the new nuclear arms race that has started, started under Obama, but it's also happening under Putin, driven by the military-industrial complexes of Russia and the United States, although the Americans are certainly more the instigators. But that these whole new whack of nuclear weapons that are coming online, and the old ones that still exist and in deteriorating situations that are not safe, the possibility of accidental nuclear war is not possible. It is certain. They think the possibility of some kind of terrorist attack using dirty bombs could be mistaken for an attack by a major power. If the dirty bomb went off in New York, if someone would have put a small nuclear bomb in a container ship and it blows up in New York Harbor, there's only a 10-second window. We're still on a hair trigger alert between Russia and the United States. 10 seconds for the militaries of both countries to decide if what just happened was an attack or terrorist attack. An accident? 10 seconds. All the people I've
talked to. You're not talking 10 minutes. You're talking 10 seconds?
10-second hair trigger that on a radar map, they see blips coming in to decide whether it's geese or bombers. Everyone uses the same phrase. It is a miracle we are still here. The miracle is because on several occasions, I think it's close to a dozen, if the protocols had been followed, the soldiers who saw the blips, or depending on the case, what the situation was, but they didn't follow orders. And that's why we're still here talking about it. And I, you know, if you want, I can give a couple examples of those cases.
Yes, please do.
I know it's out there in the press somewhat, but I learned more about it in talking with Daniel Ellsberg. I'm working on a film with Ellsberg, which is kind of why I'm into this topic, because before I started interviewing Ellsberg, I was in nuclear war denial as much as everybody else was. It just was just not in the anywhere near the front of my consciousness. You know, all of us, I think, when the Cold War ended, just kind of the whole anti-nuclear movement just went away, and people thought, oh, well, you know, Russia and the United States are going to get along now. They'll figure out the old nukes and all this. And it just receded as an issue. But all the people that know the issue say it's actually more dangerous now than it was during the Cold War. But Ellsberg woke me up to this. And one of the stories in his book, Doomsday Machine, and this documentary series I'm going to be doing is based on that book, was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was a Russian submarine underneath the American ships as the American ships were blockading Cuba. What the Americans didn't know is that the Russians had a protocol that if the submarine was out of contact with Moscow for 48 hours, if they couldn't establish radio communication, they should assume nuclear war had broken out and fire. They had some kind of nuclear tip small missiles, and they were only 40 miles off the coast of the United States. And they should fire into the United States, assuming that Russia had been attacked, Soviet Union had been attacked. Well, when the Americans didn't know about that protocol, what the Russians didn't know is the Americans had figured out how to jam communication between the submarine and Moscow. So the communication does go down for 48 hours because it's being jammed. The Russians don't know that that's the reason. The 48 hours go by, and it's time to break out the envelopes that give the trigger orders, the shoot orders. So they bring out the envelope, and the protocol is three senior officers have to sign that they've agreed it's appropriate to fire. So the captain signs, number two in command signs, and then it's up to number three. That number three is actually the guy who's the party official, and he represents the, you know, the Soviet Communist Party on the ship, and he has to sign, and he refuses. He says, what if this is a technical problem? And he actually gets disciplined when he gets home, but it's only because he refused to sign that nuclear war didn't break out during the Cuban crisis. And there's other examples like this, in both in Ellsberg's book and elsewise. We're only here because a few people refuse to follow orders, and it really is a miracle.
Who owns the nuclear weapons production industry, and is it very profitable?
Well, profit is what it's all about, and this is what's ridiculous. People have to understand how systemically dangerous capitalism is now, and this nothing says it more than the fact that it's purely profit driving the nuclear war strategy of the United States. Daniel Ellsberg has a line which he says, the nuclear weapons program after World War II was a commercial subsidy for the aerospace industry. That there simply was no military justification to develop a nuclear wars program, a nuclear weapons program after World War II. He points to the ICBMs. The whole ICBM program is obsolete. Billions and billions invested in existing ICBMs and new ICBMs coming online. But ICBMs, according to all the military experts that I've read, are easy targets. The intelligence on both sides, Russia and the United States, and Chinese for that matter. The Chinese are a little bit of an exception here because the Chinese have not built their nuclear force out anywhere near to the extent of Russia and the United States. But they know where the ICBMs are. They're essentially targets, and they're not that effective as a deterrent. What is effective as a deterrent are nuclear-armed submarines because they move around. It's hard to track where they are, and they have more than enough armaments to end life on Earth. But ICBMs continue because they're very expensive, and the armaments industry makes tons of money out of making them. But if you want to go to the beginnings of this and understand the profit motive, I interviewed a guy named Lester Ernest. And he was part of a program at MIT in around 1959, 1960. He had joined the Army. He got into the early computer program of the U.S. Army. When he got out, MIT asked him to come, and he started working on something called the SAGE radar system. And the SAGE radar system is in the Dr. Strangelove movie, and maybe in some others, and you see this great big board where they can track incoming airplanes, and they supposedly know everything. And the SAGE radar system was connected to Bomark missiles. And what SAGE would do is if Russian bombers were flying in, the computer system, and this was the largest gathering of computer power in the history of the world at the time. And in fact, some of the technology that led to the creation of the internet came out of the work done to develop the SAGE radar system. And they were going to track these bombers and then hit them with Bomark missiles. And this gave everyone the assurance that the United States would be safe and with developing their own nuclear armaments threat. and this defense system, they didn't have to worry. Even, there was even an underlying suggestion that the United States could conduct a first strike against the Soviet Union and still be safe because of SAGE and the Bismarck missiles. So anyway, Lester goes to work at MIT, and he gets there. He's there 2 or 3 days, and he turns to one of his colleagues, and he says, you know, how did you guys figure out the radar jamming systems? Because we know the Soviet planes and our planes, everybody's got radar jamming now. And Lester told me, and I have this on camera, Lester says, there's a long silence. And the guy says to him, well, we didn't really figure that out. And Lester says, well, then there's none of this works. And the guy says, well, we don't talk about that. The whole thing was a fraud. They spent, in today's dollars, $1 trillion over about 25 years, and the whole thing was a scam. And the manufacturers of the SAGE radar system, the manufacturer of the Bismarck missiles, which they then, this is another great one, I love this one. Lester's asked to go to Congress. And this is asked by the armaments people, some of the Pentagon people, to go to Congress and get them to agree that the Bismarck missiles that are going to shoot down these Soviet planes should be armed with nuclear missiles, nuclear warheads, I'm sorry. And Lester, I said to Lester, I said, hold on for a second. So you're going to go to Congress and get them to recommend that Soviet bombers flying over Canada and the United States with nuclear weapons are going to be hit by missiles with nuclear weapons. And all this is going to happen over Canadian and American territory. And this is making everyone safe. I said, excuse my language. That's fucking insane. And Lester says, of course it's insane. I said, did you do it? He said, yeah, I went and they agreed. And the Bismarck missiles were armed with nuclear missiles. I said, why did you do it? He said, you know, we were just at that point in it for the money. We all thought we were all going to die. We all thought nuclear war was going to end everything. And we were just so cynical, and we were getting paid so much. And the whole culture was about money sloshing around. The manufacturers of the radar, the weapons, and so on. The Pentagon, everybody was in on it. And we went along with it. He since, you know, regrets it all. He's now, he became the founder of the Artificial Intelligence Lab at Stanford University and fought for open source and against trademark and copyrights and things. And, he really kind of woke him up eventually. But this whole fraud is at the heart of the nuclear war planning. And as we know, that nuclear war doesn't now just mean the destruction of all the major cities of the United States, the Soviet Union, of course, Europe is gone. But it used to be thought, oh, well, that's only the Northern Hemisphere. At least humans will survive in the Southern Hemisphere. Well, that's not true either. It's now pretty clear that there'll be something called nuclear winter and that the firestorms created by the burning of the cities will create so much smoke and ash in the atmosphere that it will be the end of agriculture all around the globe. And this business, the manufacturing of the nuclear weapons, the Pentagon strategists, Congress that buys into it, Obama, and then Trump, and of course all the presidents since Truman, they go along with this because of the pressure of the military-industrial complex and the whole culture of proving that America's the greatest hegemon and so on. It's put life on Earth at risk. But while there's political considerations, geopolitical considerations, you know, this is still the grand chessboard for the people that think about these things. The heart of it is money making.
We've got about 10 more minutes, Paul, and I've got three more questions for you. Does America's dominant global commercial position depend on military might, including the nuclear arsenal?
That's a good question. It certainly doesn't depend on the nuclear arsenal, really. But that's not to say the nuclear arsenal isn't used. It is used as a threat, against non-nuclear countries. So there's always this, take Iran, there's always sort of in the back of the confrontational discourse between the United States and Iran, the threat that a tactical nuclear weapon could be used against Iran. And in fact, Sheldon Adelson, you know, the billionaire who's the big supporter of the far-right forces in Israel, and he helped elect Trump, he's the one that financed Trump, he's actually said on a panel in 2013 in New York that the United States should seriously consider dropping a tactical nuclear weapon in an Iranian desert to send the Iranians a message of what's in store for them. And as insane as that is, and as insane as Sheldon Adelson is, Sheldon Adelson has the ear of Donald Trump. And even before that, Adelson had the ear of very powerful Republicans that he would donate money to. So nuclear weapons as a threat help enforce American dominance, but it's not needed. Is the military might needed? Well, look at the inroads China's making. China's become the greatest trading partner of Brazil. It's the number two or number one trading partner of every other country in Latin America. It's ahead of the United States now in Africa. It certainly competes with, and in many countries is ahead of, commercial relationships throughout Asia. So where is this great military machine preventing the commercial growth of the commercial power of China? It's not. So the competition for commercial hegemony, commercial global dominance, the military maybe in the older days played that kind of role, where Americans would directly go intervene with American troops and do regime change and get a pro-American regime. But how'd that work out in Iraq? You know, they not only did not get a pro-American government, they did not even get control of the oil in Iraq. Interesting enough, Chinese oil companies, last I saw, had more contracts than the American ones did because of the great anti-American sentiment amongst the Iraqi people. Now, they got a government in Iraq that's at least as aligned with Iran as it is with the United States. You know, those days of being able to just go in, get regime change, like look at Libya. You know, Libya was a grab. The Libyan war was about Libyan oil, obviously. Well, now what you have is chaos, and the Russians are making a big inroad in Libyan oil. So where is it that the military actually supports such commercial dominance? I'm not saying it doesn't do anything. I'm sure in some situations, the power of the American armed forces, certainly in the Middle East, where they in Bahrain, where they have a big fleet, the fact that the army's right there, it helps prop up the monarchy of Bahrain and Saudi Arabia. It's not that it doesn't play any role, but it doesn't play that significant a role, because every time they actually try to use the military to intervene, it's a debacle.
Paul J., why in this time of the COVID-19 pandemic, the great civil unrest, 40 million people unemployed, why is this a good time to raise the issue of nuclear disarmament?
Well, because the threat is so imminent, and most people have no sense of it at all. Even on, you know, the left, when I tell people I'm working on a film with Ellsberg about the doomsday machine, they raise their eyebrows and say, well, you know, we've survived it this long. There's no reason to think we won't survive it longer. And climate is far more dangerous an issue, the climate crisis. And I would say the answer is two things. One is, do you want to trust a class, political institutions that couldn't deal with a virus with nuclear weapons and Armageddon? You're going to trust our fate to those people? They couldn't prepare for a virus that they knew about for years? These are the people you're going to trust with the survival of humans? The second reason I'd say why now is I think the pandemic has made the unthinkable thinkable. This idea, even though we knew there was a pandemic coming, it just wasn't real. It was abstract. the same way climate change is still abstract for so many people. But it's a dose of reality. And it's a shredding of the sort of bubble that entertainment culture creates, that we're all, you know, as long as you're not poor, as long as you're not a poor person of color, life is okay. And okay enough that it's better to just live in the comfort of denial. Well, the pandemic has broken down a lot of that comfort of denial. The other thing about the issue of nuclear weapons, while there are some immediate issues that need to be demanded, for example, the elimination of ICBMs, the reduction at the very least of nuclear weapons down to 10 or 20 at the max, enough that you could say there's a deterrent, because Ellsberg believes you just can't win the argument at this stage of not having any weapons at all. But you make the situation so much safer if you're down to 10 or 20 and not thousands. So that's an immediate issue. But when you go beyond that kind of issue, the solution to the problem of the nuclear threat is the same solution as it is for climate crisis. Frankly, it's the same solution for dealing with future pandemics. It's the same solution for dealing with poverty. We have to deal with who has power. We have to deal with democratizing the economy and the development of converting military production to green production and democratizing the politics. And it's all about developing, I think, public economic institutions, starting with banking as a public utility, and eroding the power of Wall Street. Because you asked who owns the nuclear armaments manufacturing companies? Well, the same companies that, interesting enough, own the media. The same institutional investors, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, the other big asset managers and financial institutions that own 93% of the New York Times, own Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing. The 12 companies that are the major manufacturers of nuclear weapons are all primarily owned by the same institutional investors that control, ready for this, 90% of the S&P 500. The concentration of ownership that's taken place since 2007-8 crisis, where these massive asset management companies like BlackRock, led by this guy Larry Fink, who might be Biden's Secretary of the Treasury, BlackRock is the company that just got handed the contract by the Federal Reserve to dole out this, $700 billion, I can't remember the number, to corporations and so on. They own the companies that make all the weapons, including nuclear weapons. The same companies own the majority controlling interest of all the major fossil fuel companies, except for Total from France. They own all the major corporate media, with the exception of Bloomberg, which is privately owned, and the Washington Post, which is privately owned. But everything that's publicly owned is controlled by the same massive asset management companies. And it's not like this is the evil Dr. Strangelove. These guys are just, that's what they do. They invest and they need maximum return on their capital. Like, whose money is BlackRock investing? Pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, billionaires' money. Between the three top asset management companies, they control $14 trillion. That's more than the GDP of China. Bloomberg says by 2020, they're going to control more assets than the GDP of the United States. It's a machine. It's a blind machine, the way this capitalism works. The consciousness it creates in the people that are the elites and the people that manage these big institutions. They may individually understand how bloody insane it is, just the way Lester Ernest understood how insane the SAGE radar system was. But they can't stop doing it. It's just what it is and who they are. It only changes with a mass movement that demands these kinds of economic and democratic reforms with a power in the streets that far surpasses what we're seeing, and far more conscious, not burning down buildings for no reason, but millions and millions of people in the streets combined with an electoral strategy to elect progressive candidates. And if we don't do it, we're doomed.
Well, Paul Jay, I think this is a fitting time to end our interview. How can people follow your work?
We're at on the web, www, if people still say that, theanalysis.news. Or if it's easier to remember, you can do theanalysis.com.
Excellent. Paul J., it's been very enlightening having a chance to talk with you. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And you be safe and be well.
Same for you, Michael, and thanks very much.
Yeah, take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.